Welcome to The Red-Haired Archaeologist. I am your host, author, and sunscreen advocate, Amanda Hope Haley. Thank you for spending some time with me today, studying artifacts our first century Near Eastern ancestors left behind, and considering if those items just might change how we read or read into scripture. This season on the podcast, I'm talking a lot about the trip that I took back in 2019 with my family, and it is the trip that spawned the book that just came out this past Tuesday called The Red-Haired Archaeologist Digs Israel. It was sort of a do-it-yourself tour for us. I have a background in doing some tour planning, and I thought that maybe since there were so many places I wanted to see that were sort of off the beaten path and not on the typical, say, Christian tourist's tour of Israel, I thought that maybe money and time would be better spent if I could figure out a way for us to do it ourselves. And something that I realized pretty quickly is that most of the places that I wanted to see in Israel, most of the archaeological sites that were open to the public, they all fall under the purview of the Israel Nature and Parks Authority. So sort of the same thing, you know, we have here in the U.S., our national park system. Israel has the same thing. But what's different over there is that I'd say most of their natural areas aren't just beautiful, aren't just places to go and visit and hike, although that's certainly part of it, but they're actually sites where ancient civilizations once were. And so really the cheapest way to get a good view of literally thousands of years of history in Israel is to just buy the annual pass for the Israel Nature and Parks Authority. You can go online. And I think it costs about $40 US. Obviously, that fluctuates. And if you get their unlimited access pass, it lasts for 2 weeks and you can go to all of the parks and sites that are a part of that. This includes everything from little places you've never heard of to medium-sized places like we're going to talk about today, which is a place called Bet Guvrin Marishah, or all the way up to the really biggies. I call them the biggies, like Masada. We'll talk about Masada in a later episode, but that is a massive archaeological site. As long as you have the pass, you can essentially go for free. All you have to pay for is the tram ride up there. It's a really wonderful system that they have in place, and it makes it incredibly economical to see a whole lot of things in a really, really short period of time in Israel without having to hire tour guides or anything like that. I'm not saying tour guides are bad. We took some tours ourselves while we were out there, but one thing that we noticed in a lot of sites, really especially at Masada, was that when tour groups would come in, obviously they'd be larger groups of people and everyone's straining to listen to the person who's leading the tour, but a lot of times those people, they're on such a schedule because they have so much to accomplish in one day. A place like Masada requires an entire day there to see everything that you want to see. People might get just an hour or two if you're part of a group. If you can get there on your own and just take advantage of what the Nature and Parks Authority has set up there, you're going to be in good shape. There are brochures for all of these sites. A lot of sites have audio tours or tour guides who are there on site who can tell you what you want to know, and none of that costs any extra. So it takes a little more effort on your part. You need to be a reader. You need to be a person who likes to kind of stand around in museums and really stare at things for a while and put it all together for yourself. To me, it's worth it. You can learn as much as you want to and as much as you have time for. Several of these sites, actually 9 sites in Israel, are part of what is called the UNESCO World Heritage Sites. There are sites all over the world. UNESCO stands for United Nations Educational, Scientific, and Cultural Organization. And so the UN has set up this organization where they go into nations all over the world and they select sites. And basically, they protect them. When they're selected, they're given a lot of money. And that makes it easier for the countries where the sites are to protect them and maintain them and maybe even bring them up to a certain code so that more people can visit than would be able to, you know, without the influx of that money. I was surprised to learn that Israel only has 9 sites that are UNESCO sites. I would have expected it to be a lot more, only because it's such an ancient area and it's an important place for the 3 major world religions. As it turns out, Israel is nowhere near the top far as having the greatest number of sites. There are 9 official sites in Israel. They have 18 that are kind of pending approval, pending a vote by the UN. but they actually rank 32nd in the list of countries that have UNESCO sites. Italy, as it turns out, has the absolute most. They have 55. So compare that to the 9 in Israel. Today, we're going to talk about one of those UNESCO World Heritage Sites. It is the National Park of Beit Guvrin-Maresha. These are actually two cities in antiquity, but they were very, very close together. And what is interesting about them is that they have a massive system of caves that are partially above ground, but of course, caves like mostly below ground. And these caves were in use between 700 BCE and 900 CE. So for 800 years, these spaces were being used by people from different communities. I want to pause for a second right here and explain the dating system that I'm using. If you were a Christian or raised in the westernized world, you are probably familiar with the designations BC, before Christ, and AD, Anno Domini, which basically means the time after Jesus was born. That comes from what we would call the Christian calendar. And in Israel, especially, a country where there are Christian, Jewish, and Islamic people living there to this day, a lot of history revolving around all of those traditions, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for scholars to be constantly using a Christian calendar, especially when you're talking about things that may have happened thousands of years before Jesus was born. And so at some point, the decision was made by the scholarly community to go with BCE and CE. CE means common era. So BCE is before the common era. And this works. This is a system that everybody seems to be pretty good with. And it takes a lot of confusion out of it. Because just at a very basic level, if you think about how people of different religions interpret the date, for Christians and for most of the westernized world, this is the year 2021. But on the Hebrew Jewish calendar, this is the year 5781. So you've got, you know, more than a 3,000 year difference there. And then on the Islamic calendar, it's 1442. And so if you're doing archaeology pertaining to Islam, it might not make sense to be talking about years in AD, just working with the common era, something that everyone just kind of agrees on, that works well for everyone. It just sort of flattens everything out and helps us to focus on what the dates are. The first mention of Maresha is in the Bible. It is found in the book of Joshua at verse 1544. And this is a section in the Bible where the promised land is being carved up for the separate tribes of Israel. And Maresha is given to the tribe of Judah. This city is, if you were to look at a map today, it's located halfway between the Mediterranean Sea and the Dead Sea. On a north to south perspective, it's sort of halfway between Tel Aviv and Beersheba. It is somewhat closer down to Beersheba. So this would have been toward the southern edge of the tribe of Judah's lands, and it would have been right on the edge of the nation of Philistia during the time of David. The first place that you get a story about Maresha, that it's more than just mentioned as a point on the map, comes in 2 Chronicles chapter 11. And at this point in the Bible, we have learned that the United Kingdom of Israel, which had been ruled by David and Solomon, both of them had it as one united kingdom. When Solomon died, it was split in two. So you had the Northern Kingdom, which went on to be called Israel, and the Southern Kingdom, which was made up of the tribes of Judah and Benjamin, but it was kind of colloquially known as the Kingdom of Judah. In 2 Chronicles 11, we learn that King Rehoboam, who was ruling Judah, he goes into Maresha and he fortifies it because they are starting to have conflict with the kingdom of Egypt. So that's the first we hear about it. And then a generation later, 2 Chronicles chapter 20, you hear about it again. It's just sort of mentioned because a guy named Eleazar, he is a prophet. He is given one verse of scripture. It is 2 Chronicles 20:37. He comes out and he prophesies against a later Judean king, King Jehoshaphat. King Jehoshaphat had just made an alliance with the king of the northern kingdom of Israel, and the two had come together to work together against the foreign country of Moab. The northern kingdom of Israel at the time were extremely rebellious against God, and so this prophet, Eleazar, comes out and tells Jehoshaphat that bad things are going to happen because of this alliance that he made with the king of the north. So anyway, Maresha is mentioned there. And then it really comes to the fore again right around 586 BC. In 586, famously, the Babylonians came in. They conquered Jerusalem, destroyed it, burned it, flattened it, took all the people who were living there, and sent them to live in other parts of the Babylonian nation. A generation or so after that, in 539, the Persians then conquered the Babylonians. And it's at that point, so Mareshah was destroyed to a degree by the Babylonians. And then after the Persians came in and some of the Jews were allowed to come back and start rebuilding Jerusalem and rebuilding Israel, at that time, the Idumeans or the Edomites, they're the same people, they come from the land of Edom. They had lived toward the southern area of the Dead Sea and like on the eastern side of it was where they were before. Well, they kind of came around the bottom of the Dead Sea and moved into this area of Mareshah. And they lived there for a couple of hundred years until Alexander the Great came in. Remember, in Israel, it is just a constant succession of people coming in and conquering. So, I mean, you have Israel, then the Babylonians, then the Persians, then the Greeks, then the Romans. Okay, so Alexander comes in 333 BCE, and around about that time, Sidonians, you hear in the Bible about Tyre and Sidon, these are coastal Mediterranean nations. So the Sidonians and people from other areas of Greece and Macedonia end up moving into Mareshah. And at that point, Mareshah becomes, it comes to life again. It becomes, it's very, very Hellenistic. You start to see a lot of influences of foreign gods and their artwork, that sort of thing. We'll talk about it in a minute. It's a city again. It's a cultural center. And it stays that way for a couple of hundred years until around 113 BCE. In Israel, they have been ruled for the Greeks for a long time. And there is a family called the Maccabees. Eventually, the name changes to Hasmoneans. They start engaging in what are called the Jewish Wars. As a Protestant, I wasn't taught a whole lot about this in church. I don't know that I was taught anything about this. We would sometimes talk about, especially around Easter, we would talk about the period of silence in the Bible between the Old Testament and the New Testament, the 400 years of silence. And we never really learned what happened in those 400 years. I always, as a child, just had this impression of people just sitting around, sitting on their hands and waiting on the Messiah to come. And of course, that was true to a degree, but actually a lot of stuff happened there historically. And so in other Christian traditions, the Catholic tradition for one, many of the Orthodox churches, they have extra books of the Bible that fill in that gap. And some of those are the books of the Maccabees. There are four of them. I don't come from a tradition that believes that they are sacred. They are excellent history books. If you want to know what was happening during that 400 years of silence, that is a great resource. It's a great place to go. And it tells the story of the Jewish Wars and this family of the Maccabeans coming together and pushing out their rulers and forming their own government. And so around 113, a guy named John Hyrcanus came to power. He was the grandson of one of the original Maccabees who got all this started. So he goes down to Mareshah and basically takes it back and does his best to push all the Greek influence out of it. He's even trying to force people to convert to Judaism, which was pretty unprecedented at the time. But in the course of him ruling Israel and ruling the area, that city actually ends up getting destroyed. This story, you can read it in depth in 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Shouldn't be too hard to find. So after he does this, and Mareshah basically ceases to exist as a functional city, the city of Bet-Gavrin pops up. It's basically across the street, if you will. We'll talk about the caves in a minute, but it's still part of this cave system. That is where, from basically the New Testament time period up through the Muslim time period, that is where the city is. So the city center just kind of shifts from being in Mareshah to being at Bet-Gavrin. When we got to the national park, we found that it was like most of the other national parks in Israel and, I mean, really in the U.S. to a certain degree. You pull into a nice little parking lot and there was a great little visitor center. I always recommend that you start at a visitor center whenever you can, just to get some good basic information. Right there, we got a brochure. Inside was a map and it gave us a suggestion of how to tour around the entire site, and also had marked bike paths and hiking paths and places essentially for recreation, which you lived in the area and this is a place you frequented all the time. I mean, how awesome to be able to just go hiking among ruins that are thousands and thousands of years old. The park itself takes up about 1,200 acres, so it's pretty large. Over about 700 of those acres, maybe closer to 800, is a system of caves. There are over 500 caves. They are carved out of this soft, light-colored chalk-type rock. Very, very soft, and they are man-made. They were carved by people. They are not natural, and so that in and of itself is part of what makes this place so fascinating, is that 500 of these caves were just made somewhere between 700 and 800 BCE, and they stayed in use all the way up into and through part of the Muslim period. Everything that you can possibly think of happened inside of these caves, I mean, from an ancient perspective. They were used as stables. There's evidence of olive oil presses in some of them. Some of them were used like Roman baths or mikvahs, actually specialized ritualistic baths in some places. Of course, they were tombs. We'll talk about those in just a second. One of the more interesting sites to me are the existence of dovecotes. This may not be a word you're really familiar with, but you've probably heard of pigeonholes. Actually, if you look at the cover of my book, the photograph that is on there is of something that's called a dovecote. That's one word, D-O-V-E-C-O-T-E. Those were structures where doves or other small birds were housed. For the ancient world, these small birds were very important. On a very base level, they were used for food. They were eaten for their meat. They were used for their eggs. Their droppings were used to make fertilizer. In the Jewish community, they were used for sacrifices at the temple. Later on, especially you actually see this at Megiddo, where they have lots of dovecotes. They were even used for communication. Think of like, you know, a carrier pigeon, essentially. These birds were, I think, unexpectedly important to ancient life. And there are literally thousands of these little bitty cubby holes for birds throughout these 500 caves. Some other caves that didn't hold birds had some cubby holes of their own, but those cubby holes were significantly larger. In fact, if you look at the image that I have posted to go along with this particular episode of the podcast, you will see some ancient tombs. In the Hellenistic period, which that's where these tombs are from, people would, they would take these caves and carve niches into them. And very often when a person passed away, they would be laid on the floor, or in some cases, there may be a raised slab in the center of the room or something like that, but the body would be allowed to decay. And then once nothing but bones were left, those bones would be put into these little cubbies. These particular tombs that are present at Bet Gubrin are, I mean, they're just absolutely beautiful. You walk down a staircase into them. No light really gets in except what has been provided by later excavations. It's very cool in there. And it's actually a really, really beautiful place. The walls are almost white from that natural chalk. They're very soft to the touch. There are a few places where they allow you to kind of touch and feel. There have been restorations done to the friezes that were painted all on these walls. These particular friezes show that the people who were buried in these tombs were wealthy and were prominent. In fact, in one of them, it's the family of the man who governed the city for over 30 years. His name and the names of his relatives, those have been, you know, painted onto the walls, as well as these pictures of people playing musical instruments and all kinds of animals, some domesticated, some wild, even a couple of maybe mythical ones, some animals that come out of Greek mythology, and then just household items, vases, ribbons. The walls are just beautifully decorated. And it's unlike anything that I've ever seen anywhere else in Israel. A stop at this park, although maybe it's a little bit off of the beaten path of most of the tours that happen in Israel, it's well worth your time. It's unlike anything else, really, that I've seen there. Other places where there are caves, thinking specifically of Qumran, that is in a place where it's still just hot and dry and arid. Being inside the caves, it's not as cool as you might expect. Whereas here, you're in a lovely area that's trees. And when you walk down the chalk steps into these subterranean, cool, man-carved caves, it's an experience unlike anything else that you would have anywhere else in Israel. If you find yourself somewhere in between visiting the Philistine sites over on the Mediterranean, maybe you're on your way to the Dead Sea after doing all of that, this is a great place just to stop for a little while. If you have the park pass, it wouldn't cost you anything to go in there and take a look around. It's absolutely worth doing. If you enjoyed this episode of The Red-Haired Archaeologist, then I hope you will listen again soon. New episodes are released each Friday. To learn more about me, check out my website, redhairedarchaeologist.com. There you will find links to my books, this podcast, and my blog, where you can interact with me and other listeners. Also look for my new book, The Red-Haired Archaeologist Digs Israel. It is available now as a print book, ebook, and audiobook from all of your favorite retailers.